طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. We ask our listeners, as we do every week, were you involved last week in the Palestine-Israel peace movement and the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's savage military attacks against them to force them out of their homes and annex their properties into Israel? Did you speak out on the atrocities Israel is committing every day in Gaza and the West Bank? If not, why not? What is your reason not to?
That was the voice of our dearest late Sharifa. My name is Salma Abu Ayyash, and I am your host today, Sunday, January 9th, 2010. Happy New Year, everyone. Alas, the New Year in Palestine was not so great. It was stained by the news of the killing of Jawahar Abu Rahma by deadly inhalation of U.S.-made, probably military-grade tear gas, causing either blood poisoning or cardiac arrest and death. This was the first victim of 2011. The second Palestinian killed by Israeli soldiers was a 21-year-old Mohammed Jarmat, shot at checkpoint with soldiers claiming he did not obey orders. The Red Crescent, on the other hand, added that Dragma was shot in his chest and buttocks while walking towards the roadblock, and witnesses to the shooting said that he had both of his hands over his head before two soldiers, male and female, shot him from a distance that does not exceed 3 meters. He was not armed and only had a Coke in hand, and that just before he was shot, he was walking next to some female soldiers. The soldiers then opened fire at him from different directions. Soldiers also shot and killed an elderly man while sleeping in his bed this past Friday, just a couple days ago. The family found the body of Omar soaked with blood and riddled with bullets. Apparently, the soldiers thought that he was a Hamas member who was just released from Palestinian prisons. They got the wrong apartment. Indeed, not a good start for Palestinians in the new year, but not an atypical week in Palestine. Going back to Jawahar, and according to an AOL news report, last Friday was supposed to be a special day for her as her cousin was having an engagement party that night, and she had brought a case of Coke as a special gift. Standing outside her small cinder block home in the village of Bil'in, near the West Bank town of Ramallah, she saw the weekly demonstration against the Israeli wall pass by. Jawahar and her mother, Subhiyah, decided to join them. Quote, "We weren't even very close to them, and the soldiers fired tear gas at us," said Subhiyah. "Jawahar told me that her chest hurt and she couldn't breathe. Then she fell down and started vomiting." Subhiyah stayed with her daughter in the ambulance, where she lost consciousness. Jawahar, 35, died the next morning on January 1, 2011. Quote, "The cause of death was cardiac arrest after inhalation of gas," Dr. Mohammed Aida, the General Director of Emergency Medical Services of the Palestinian Ministry of Health, told AOL News. "According to the family, there was no history of any illness, and I have no doubt she died from tear gas. She was connected to a respirator as soon as she arrived at the hospital, but never regained consciousness." The Israeli Defense Army, of course, denied that tear gas was the cause of death. Jawahar was buried next to her brother, Bassem, one of the uncelebrated Gandhis of Palestine, who was killed in April 2009 at a similar demonstration when Israeli soldiers fired a high-velocity tear gas canister directly at his chest. High-velocity tear gas does not give protesters any time to move out of the way of this, basically what ends up being a grenade right into their bodies. Another brother, Ashraf, was filmed being shot by Israeli soldiers in 2008 with a rubber bullet while he was bound and blindfolded. He survived. The soldier who shot him, and whose cold-blooded action was filmed and broadcast around the globe, was recently acquitted and is back in service. Bil'in is located less than a mile from the apartheid wall, and residents say half of their farmland has been taken for building the burial wall, and for nearby Jewish settlements. In 2007, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled that the Israeli government must reroute the wall to lessen the damage to Belayin, but despite the court ruling, the wall has not been moved. Last October, Israeli military court also sentenced Abdullah Abu Rahma, same family, a 39-year-old school teacher from Belayin also. He was fined and sentenced to a year in prison for incitement and organizing quote-unquote illegal demonstrations. This happened amid criticism from the European Union and human rights organizations that were monitoring the proceedings. And they claimed or stated that the conviction was totally politically motivated. Abdullah has since 2005 been the coordinator of the grassroots unarmed Palestinian resistance movement to Israel's security barrier, Israel's apartheid wall in Belayin. Speaking before the sentences, Abu Rahma rejected the Israeli charges and vowed to continue his protest activities. He said, "We want to continue our struggle. We want to continue our rights until we have freedom and independence to remove the wall, to remove the settlements, to remove all of these things and this illegal wall and arresting the people. And we will not stop because this is our right. This is our land. We must continue this until we have freedom." End of quote. The military prosecution is likely to appeal this sentencing, as they did in the case of Adib Abu Rahma, also from the same family in Belayin, who was also sentenced for 12 months on similar charges, but is still in prison after almost 17 months pending the decision about the prosecution's appeal. Listeners, this is the face of the occupation and the continued racist colonization of Palestine. Just one family story. A local Brookline MD and member of American Jews for a Just Peace, Aleth Rothschild, was at the weekly demonstration this past Friday, and she reported that protesters coming back from the direct interactions brought back empty tear gas canisters labeled CST. It is a weapon made in the USA. She said in a message that has been circulating, quote, "I was crying from the tear gas and from my sorrow and rage at the Israeli government with U.S. support, thank you, Mr. Obama, for its continued endless land grab and brutality towards its Palestinian neighbors and for Palestinian resiliency and bravery fighting back despite endless losses. They are desperately in need of international recognition and, more importantly, international pressure against the behavior of the Israeli government. I was particularly pained by the many Palestinians wearing yellow stars with the word Palestinian inscribed on it, evocating of the Jews in the ghettos of Europe forced to wear yellow stars. So now, in the modern Western democracy of Israel, Jewish ghettos dot the West Bank landscape with Palestinians themselves are further ghettoized by the machinery of occupation and colonization." Again, this was a quote from Alice Rothschild, whom we've interviewed on this radio program many times before. This past Friday, there was another demonstration, a weekly demonstration, and three people were injured in the protest commemorating Jawahar. I have the pleasure today to have with us a dear friend, Matan Cohen. Matan is a 22-year-old Israeli activist who is currently an undergrad at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. Hampshire College, if you remember, is the first of any college or university in the U.S. to divest from companies due to their involvement in the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Matan was at the helm of that successful campaign. He is a member of Jewish Voices for Peace and one of the founders of Anarchist Against the Wall, awall.org, which is a direct action group that was established in 2003 in response to the construction of the wall Israel is building, or mostly finished building on Palestinian land and in occupied West Bank. The group works in cooperation with Palestinians in a joint popular struggle against the occupation. A few years ago, he was injured from a rubber bullet fired by Israeli Defense Army during an anti-apartheid wall rally in the West Bank. He's with us from his home in, I believe, Tel Aviv. Is that correct, Matan?
In Haifa.
Haifa, I am sorry. Well, welcome to the show, Matan.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Matan, you're not a stranger to Belayin and other villages which engage in weekly protests against Israel's continued colonization of Palestine. Describe to us what you experienced during those demonstrations, especially the recent ones. Who was there? You just talked to me about skunk water, and of course we know about the tear gas. Tell us a little bit about what is a typical demonstration in Belayin.
Well, let me just give you a brief overview of what has been happening over the last couple of years in the struggle against the wall.
Very good.
I think that up until today, we've participated in some 2,000 protests in dozens of villages throughout the occupied West Bank, in which 21 Palestinian protesters were shot to death, over 3,000 were injured, and thousands others were arrested and thrown in jail, like Abdallah that you mentioned before. Mm-hmm. So the basic scenario for most of those protests is that between dozens or hundreds or thousands of protesters march nonviolently towards the route of the wall, and typically before we even reach the construction site itself, the Israeli occupation forces and border police respond, throwing stun grenades, tear gas, and at times shooting rubber bullets and also live ammunition. The protests in Bilayin have begun in 2005, almost 6 years ago now. And as you said in your introduction, two of those protesters of the same family, two brothers, have been, two siblings, have been killed in those protests. In Bilayin, the wall has annexed over two-thirds of the land that used to belong to them, on which Israel has constructed over 3,000 housing units in the settlement of Modi'in Elit. Once again, we have to recall that Israel's argument for the construction of the wall is that it's constructed for security reasons. But as we've seen time and again throughout the West Bank, in particular case in Bilayin, is the fact that the land is being used to expand settlements and not for any sort of security reasons. I think that what we've done in those protests against the wall, which are led by Palestinians and joined by Israeli and international activists, is, I think, to tip the balance and transform the way in which people see this wall. I remember when we began in 2002, there was an utter complete consensus, both in Israel and in the international community, that this wall was a just response to Israel's security problems. I think that by now, everyone across the globe know precisely that this wall has nothing to do with security and is another apparatus meant to expand Israel's control militarily and settlement-wise in the occupied territories, and another element by which Israel attempts to dissect the Palestinian society. And we have to understand that this construction of the wall is connected inherently to the siege on Gaza, to roads that are meant for Jews only, and so on and so forth, and all of which are aimed at one thing, to expropriate Palestinian land and to maximize Israeli control on this land and slowly but steadily remove Palestinian populations from these areas. And our steadfast resistance here is basically a sign to Israel's government and people that we will not step back and we'll keep on resisting regardless what the price may be. And the price at times is heavy. But I think that we are convinced that there is no other choice. And I think that many across the world are growing with us in this movement in realizing that this is the only alternative. And if one supports any sort of sustained peace or resolution to this area, one also has to support the struggle, and the two cannot be separated.
Thank you, Matan. And I may mention to our listeners also that the apartheid wall construction hasn't finished. And we often hear of laborers crossing in, illegally as far as Israel is concerned, and other just ordinary people going in and out. So if, quote-unquote suicide bombers wanted to go in Israel and continue, you know, that kind of action, they can easily still do it. So the whole security argument is not true. Can you just also describe to us, a typical demonstration? What kind of weapons do the Israeli army use, and how do they try to quash these popular resistance and peaceful demonstrations of Palestinians and international activists?
Absolutely. I can just briefly describe to you the protest in which Zawaha was killed. I was really close by. In fact, in the ambulance just before she was brought on to it. At that day, a week and a half ago, we left the center of town, roughly 1,000 of us, marching towards the site of the wall, which, as you said, is roughly, I would say, half a mile away from the center of town, maybe a bit more. As we were marching, And far, far, far before we reached the Israeli soldiers who were waiting and are waiting every week there behind the fence itself, they began shelling us with dozens of tear gas canisters, many of which were shot at very short range and directly at the protesters. They're supposed to be shot in sort of an angle which allows them to fall sort of from above rather than directly at the protesters. And this is a regulation they do not follow, their own regulation. And in fact, at times they shoot them just as rockets aimed at the protesters themselves. And as you mentioned before, Bassem Abu Ahmed was shot and killed by one of those U.S.-manufactured tear gas canisters.
Mm-hmm.
So as we were following the march, the entire area, after several minutes, was already covered with a cloud of tear gas. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that, I don't know, 200 feet, over 200 feet area was completely covered with tear gas canisters.
Wow.
And in tear gas cloud. I myself almost fainted, and I'm someone who's rather used to tear gas. I've been tear gas hundreds of times in my life, and that was severely bad that day. And as far as the Israeli argument that Dejaleh was not even at the protest, then they argued, as we've heard, that she had blood cancer and so on and so forth, and all those silly, idiotic, and absolutely racist excuses that the Israeli army sort of deployed. I was being brought onto the ambulance after almost fainting there. The ambulance driver got a call on the radio saying that we have a female protester, 35 years of age, roughly 150 meters away from the route, who is being very severely injured by tear gas inhalation. He then talked to me while I was at the back of the ambulance with another protester who was really fainting and said, look, I really need the ambulance. Could you please take your friend? I'll give you some medicine. Just take it, put it on his head, and could you guys just get out of the ambulance? And one of the paramedics will stay with you. We have to go right now. I said, yes, of course. We got out of the ambulance, and then I saw them rushing away with their sirens towards where I was, and we saw her being brought onto the ambulance and taken to the Ramallah hospital. So that was last week's protest. This week's protest on Friday, I came together with my two parents, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
The army, which was, I would say, rather afraid to use that excessive violence they normally use, was trying to shy away from their regular routine tactics of shooting rubber bullets and tear gas. And first they shot us with what they called a skunk water, which is, as Americans would recall from the 60s, those big water tanks with cannons that basically shoot at protesters. I think it's a sight that would bring to mind a lot of what American civil rights movement has been through in the 60s. They use this machine, this water cannon, but instead of water, they put some sort of sewage water with which they spray all the protesters. In a funny remark, my father, it was the first time for him in Bedayin or in West Bank protest at large, said, man, this thing really smells like my country. It smells like shit. and it's kind of an ironic moment to smell what their regime smells like.
That's a great
ironic
quote.
It is what they deploy against us. But in fact, I think it's a wonderful replica of how they are, what they are, and what they stand for. Anyhow, after they used it after hundreds of us basically reached the fence and started shaking it and trying to cut it open. After some time, Palestinian protesters responded to the Israeli violence, and in response to that, they began shooting tear gas once more. It was not as excessive as last week, as it was filled with media from all over the world. CNN, BBC were all live there. So they were trying to be a bit cautious, but I think the nature of their excessive violence was sort of getting ahead of them, or beyond them, so to speak, they did use this excessive violence nonetheless. But I think that this is sort of a routine thing. It's a routine procedure. And in other villages throughout the West Bank, there are still weekly protests, like in Nebi Saleh and other villages. And there they shoot live ammunition and rubber bullets. So just 2 or 3 weeks ago, a protester was shot in the head and severely injured. I think he was 17 years old.
Yes.
And this is sort of a daily occurrence.
Yes.
In the struggle.
Many villages are engaging in this, in these kind of weekly demonstrations against the continued colonization of Palestine. And as you mentioned, Nabi Saleh, Bil'in, Nalin, Budros, Jayus, my own village, Beit Umar. It is indeed true that they are using live ammunition. There's multiple YouTube videos that show that, and a lot of eyewitness accounts that they shoot even at children at times. Talking about the tear gas, I've been noticing a very sinister trend by the Israeli army to use kind of legal weapons in dispersing, if you wish, protesters in a way that will harm them and injure them pretty much deadly fashion. For example, we have Tristan Anderson, who returned, I think, 6 months ago from a full year at Tel Aviv hospital after being shot by an Israeli soldier with, a metal high-velocity tear gas canister at the wall. He was shot in 2009 while taking photos following a demonstration against the wall. You can read about Tristan at justicefortristan.org. To read about his health condition, etc. Also, not long ago, Emily Henschowitz, she was also hit in the face with a tear gas projectile. Two landed at her feet before the third hit her in the eye. So it's very obvious that she was being targeted, as her body was being targeted as the target of this tear gas. And it's clear evidence that they are misusing these quote-unquote legal mechanisms of dispersing protesters. And, of course, everybody knows about Rachel Corrie, who was simply standing using very visible, she was very visible with a loudspeaker, and she was crushed by a bulldozer. And many, many other international activists. Brian Avery comes to mind, who was shot in the face. They are targeting international activists, actually. But this usage of tear gas, as you mentioned, in not the proper ways, is becoming very clear that they are mishandling, pretty much breaking international law and breaking the probably the rules that these companies that sell them these tear gas canisters. So we mentioned the CSI, Combined Systems Inc. It's a company located in Jamestown, Pennsylvania. And that's the company that has been selling these high velocity, probably military grade, I don't know about that. I've been hearing that this tear gas is somewhat different than other tear gas you might see in a demonstration here in the U.S., and maybe, Matan, you can comment on that. But there is a petition that is circulating for CSI to stop selling tear gas to Israeli army. Not that they can't get it from other places, but just to make a point that they're using it illegally and using it as a weapon against people. I don't know if you want to add more to this, Matan.
Yeah, I think there are several things to be said here. First of all, we have to understand that the type of tear gas Israel uses is not the one being used in the United States or, say, in Western Europe.
Exactly.
Israel is one of only five countries which uses CF gas as mm-hmm. their sort of tear gas. This is in contradistinction to pepper spray or pepper spray-based tear gas, which mm-hmm. is what they use. In fact, the type of tear gas that Israel uses today is the one that countries like Somalia and, if I'm not mistaken, Burma use against their protesters mm-hmm. and has been outlawed in 1964 in Britain, for example, and in the United States, I think, several years after, precisely because it was deemed fatal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not actually called a non-lethal weapon, which is what normally those crowd disbursement weapons are supposed to be labeled, but a less lethal weapon, which is a very important distinction. So this is one thing to be said. Second of all, interestingly enough, CSI and other companies that supply the Israeli army with those equipments that they use to violate international law time and again routinely and systematically are actually obliged not only by international law but also by U.S. regulations mm-hmm. not to be involved in business trade with parties that have a record of violating international law. In fact, a New York State court has ruled not long ago that companies that are what they called, quote, willfully blind in selling equipment to countries or parties they know will probably be using that to violate international law or human rights convention, that they're culpable legally. And I think that, and this is something we'll be announcing very soon, we'll start a campaign based on these lines against CSI very soon. And I think that I'll be calling everyone in the United States to join this struggle. I think that there's a direct connection between U.S. support, military aid to Israel, and the continual repression of the Palestinian people in general and of popular resistance in particular, as we've seen in this instance. Another thing that I wanted to mention here that we haven't had the occasion to talk about is the fact that the day after Zawahir was killed, 20 of us Israeli activists from Anarchists Against the Wall were arrested in two different protests in Tel Aviv. The first one, in which I was arrested, happened when 800 of us clashed with riot police in front of Israel's Ministry of Defense in Tel Aviv. Police arrested eight of us. One of those protesters arrested was a former member of Israeli Knesset, Mossi Raz, and later I myself was arrested after being targeted. Later that night, several dozens of us came and woke the U.S. ambassador, Mr. Cunningham, in his house, in his residence, in Herzliya, just north of Tel Aviv, around 1 a.m. The protest was basically aimed precisely at this connection and relationship between U.S. aid to Israel and continual support for Israel's policies and the ongoing repression. Protesters basically handed back to the residents used tear gas canisters made in the United States and given to Israel as part of a treaty by which Israel give Israel a free military supplies every year worth roughly $3 billion. So the idea was basically, I think, to say we are tired as Israeli activists to talk to our own fellow Israelis. What we need to target right now is the United States and other countries across the world who make possible, who allow for this sort of continual occupation. Without this support, this could not have gone forth and continued as it has, and hence the blood of Zawahir and other protesters is on the hands of U.S. ambassador in Israel and other U.S. officials. And I think that what is necessary to do right now as a resistance movement, a nonviolent resistance movement, is to link the nonviolent grassroots struggle on the ground in Palestine and the growing movement across the world to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel. I think this is what we are after here in Israel as radical activists. And I think that, as I said before, we'll soon will start a campaign in the United States targeting CSI and other companies for precisely this sort of support.
Yes. I did want to address all the events and that you and other Israeli activists have been very busy with within Israel in protesting what's been going out. And Matan, I mean, you, there hasn't been a demonstration that I didn't know that you have attended, and you're constantly putting your life at risk to bring justice for the freedom of Palestinians. You and other Israeli activists are doing that very regularly. Before we talk a little bit about, you know, what's happening inside Israel as far as the left and dissent, I did also want to mention one point about rubber bullets, which are another weapons that can be used supposedly against civilian to disturb, disperse protesters. And they have been also, they're supposed to be shot at protesters' legs, if anything, I guess, you know, so not in a way that would endanger their life. And you yourself had a rubber-coated bullet hit your eye. And other Palestinians have died from rubber bullets in the past. So rubber bullets, in addition to tear gas, or less lethal tear gas, as you call it, have been misused and endangered. When we have basically international activists, Israeli activists and Palestinians going into peaceful demonstrations and being in contact with Israeli army, their life is in danger, and that's because of the way they handle them and the way they misuse these weapons. So let's talk a little bit about what you guys do in Israel. And one recent story was Jonathan Pollack, who's one of your friends from Anarchist Against the Wall. He's also a member of the International Solidarity Movement, and he's the media coordinator for the Popular Struggle Coordination Committee, which is basically a Palestinian umbrella organization for the unarmed struggle in the West Bank. He was sentenced to jail for riding his bike in Tel Aviv against the attacks of 2 years ago in Gaza. And his case has brought international attention, especially after the statement he delivered in court defying their laws, basically not asking for leniency and instead citing Israel's oppression of Palestinians, especially in Gaza. He proudly accepted the sentence. His imprisonment is part of a clear strategy of silencing dissent in the Israeli left. What can you add about Pollack and similar harassment that you have experienced, for example, whether it's interrogation, beating? I've heard about personal property of some of these Israeli activists without even search warrants. They're going into their homes and arresting and searching, etc. Can you tell us a little bit about the repression you're experiencing as an Israeli activist and Jonathan Pollack and others in your struggle?
Let me just preface everything I'm going to say by making very clear that whatever we experience as Israeli activists is nothing in comparison to what Palestinians are going through.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the fact that this is brought to international attention and gets such headlines is precisely expressive of the ways in which our blood is a bit more expensive, so to speak, than that of Palestinians. But I think what we do is to strategically use that in order to explicate and make very clear and lucid even the ways in which we're being punished as precisely the differential treatment that mm-hmm. is Israel's apartheid regime. I can say that, interestingly enough, when we began protests against the wall, the Israeli army had very strict orders from the top of the top, including the prime minister himself, that they were not allowed to shoot at Israeli protesters. But I think mm-hmm. gradually, as they saw that arrests and beatings and so on against us as Israeli solidarity activists was not enough to stop us, they began shooting at us as well. Many Israelis have been shot with tear gas and rubber bullets as well. My friend Itai was shot in 2005. I lost an eye in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan was shot in the head with a tear gas canister and suffered hematoma in the brain around that same time. Emily, as you mentioned, was shot and lost an eye too with a tear gas canister not long ago. But what we see recently also is the ways in which precisely I think because they're helpless and mm-hmm. offering any sort of progressive agenda that could sort of balance our criticism of Israel, the fact that Israel has gone so far to the right and basically that it has become an utter, full, complete fascist state, is that the repression against internal enemies, so to speak, of the state, this is what we're being labeled, enemies of the state, is on the rise. As you mentioned, Jonathan has been sentenced to 3 months in prison. We have pending roughly 150 indictments against Israeli activists. Mm-hmm. I can just tell you that I personally was arrested, I don't know, 30, 40 times in my life and have 7 indictments against me. So this is sort of a routine thing for all of us, and we're all being pressed in court. Another thing that we see recently more and more of is that the Israeli Secret Service, the Shin Bet, is trying to infiltrate groups. They've been calling basically all of the Israeli activists. They've been doing that for some time, mm-hmm. you know, since our inception, but gradually we see it more and more and more. They call people for interrogations. People get stopped at airports, like myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was recently labeled a terrorist organizer, suspect of hostile terrorist activities for my political involvement in Israel. And this, I think, is something that we'll see against other people as well. And I think in particular, they are growing more and more wary of the connection between grassroots organizing in Palestine and Israel inside and the growing BDS movement across the globe. I think this is something that they have labeled as, quote, an existential threat to the Israeli regime. And I can be very proud and say that I hope that we are. And again, not because of their manipulative and cynical rhetoric of saying, what do you call for is the destruction of the people of Israel, of the Jewish people, or so on and so forth, but rather because what we call for very simply is, yes, the end of a regime, an apartheid regime, in the same manner that, you know, to call for a dismantlement of the apartheid regime in South Africa did not mean or was not equal to saying that we want to throw white people into the sea. Right? But Israel uses this sort of rhetoric time and again in order to scare people and label any sort of dissent as something which is illegitimate. And one thing to mention about the West Bank is that each and all protests are deemed illegal. Basically, people have no right to protest. Every protest that happens is categorically illegal. And what we see in Israel itself proper within the 48 borders is that they are basically trying to do the same with us. Almost every protest is being broken up. They use more and more violence against us inside the country. And, you know, I can tell you from personal experience that they have warned myself and other people that we are very close to getting an administrative detention warrant issued against us, which, for those of you who don't know, Israel operates under emergency regulations that are from 1945, from the time of the British Mandate, according to which if the Minister of Defense has enough of a sense, so to speak, which would be the literal translation of the law, that someone is risking the security of the state, he can issue an arrest warrant for up to 6 months without any sort of judicial process, without any due process, without seeing a judge, without presenting any evidence. In other words, he can sign you a six-month period in jail without anyone ever seeing you. This, of course, has been used extensively against Palestinians. Currently, there are hundreds of Palestinians held under administrative detention, and it's very rare that it has been used against Israeli activists, and they are threatening to start using them again and again more. And this is something that I think is very telling of the manner in which they are incapable of dealing with dissent, about the ways in which dissenting views become seen more and more as illegitimate, and that every sort of critical realm for discussion, public deliberation, or critique is being hindered, is being obscured, is being pushed and shattered. And this is one of the reasons why I think, if one could have made the argument before that the role of the international community, which is critical of Israel, is to promote and push for, say, progressive Israeli voices so that they would pressure their own government to end the occupation and other segregation policies and so on. This is no longer the case. I think, and I'm saying that with great sadness. The radical movement in Israel is very small. We can be very vocal, but we are very small. We're not really growing. And if we are, we're growing from 300 to 400 people. In fact, in recent polls of the Israeli Institute for Democracy, roughly two-thirds of Israelis my age, that is under 30, said that they think there should be a public juridical official separation between Jews and non-Jews. Roughly 70% said agree to live next to a non-Jew. And
does not agree, you said, right? 70% does not agree, yes.
Yeah, and roughly, I think 57 was the number percent of people, of Jews in Israel, who said that Arabs should be stripped of all of their of their civil rights. And when this is the situation, I think that, and this is a message for all of you listening outside of this country, in the United States in particular, of why we should support BDS, of why we should support boycott and external pressure, I wish, you know, I wish it were different. The last thing I would want is to work in my own country. Mm-hmm. But I think that at this point, there's no other option. There's no progressive voices to support, really, as a sort of a feasible way to transform the situation. And I think that as long as Israel is not made to pay a price for its occupation, the occupation will not wither, and apartheid will not wither. And it's up to us, I think, across the world to do it and make it happen.
Yes. I'm just going to give a quote of something you said at a keynote speech by Netanyahu recently at the Federation of North America's General Assembly in New Orleans. Matan is often very active here in North America also in fighting his own racist leaders. You and other Jewish and Israel activities successfully interrupted his speech, and when you got up to disrupt the prime minister's speech, he was speaking of delegitimization of Israel, and you yelled out that I am an Israeli and that it is the occupation, the Gaza blockade, and the loyalty oath which delegitimizes Israel. You were one of five protesters heckling Benjamin Netanyahu. And so it's not just the occupation, it's not Gaza blockade, it's the nature of the state of Israel, which has pretty much become a fascist state. I mean, you mentioned the 1945 law, which is still in effect. And Israel will always remain in an emergency state because of the injustice and because of the, you know, its history and all of that. And it's critically, I guess Israel has escalated its repression within Israel, also against the Arab population, as you said, from the loyalty oath, which to our listeners, I mean, imagine if in the United States we come up with a loyalty oath, we become a Protestant country, for example, and we demand that every citizen of any religion to subdue and accept a loyalty oath to a state that does not represent them, basically. They have recently allowed communities to enforce racist segregation, as you mentioned. Basically, a community of Israeli Jews can decide based on quote-unquote cultural differences. Of course, what it boils down to is pure ethnic discrimination against Palestinians. So they can create communities free of non-Jews. And most recently, this is very, very recent, they have agreed to establish committees to investigate human rights groups and NGOs and people like you, Matan, who criticize Israel's racist nature or its illegal actions, or most specifically, any organization that's targeting the Israeli army, investigating the Israeli army. Can you talk a little bit on why Israel needs such laws and policies to maintain its existence, basically?
I mean, it's interesting because I'm actually writing a lot about this in my sort of academic hat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a wonderful saying by Freud, I think it's from World War I, which says, as the insecurity of a society increases, its recourse to more and more what he called neurotic lawmaking mm-hmm. increases as well, which is to say, in other words, that insofar as a state or a society are incapable of articulating or deliberating on the reasoning for their actions or beliefs, the more that they take recourse to excessive lawmaking, the nature of which is precisely to limit that very discussion. Mm-hmm. I think what it means with respect to Israel is that a country which is founded on discriminatory laws mm-hmm. And whose nature is exclusionary by de jure, so to speak, not only de facto, is one which, as pressure against it rises and against internal critique of it becomes more and more apparent and outspoken, the more recourse they need to take to actually formalize segregation that before, I think, was sort of a matter of habit mm-hmm. or a matter of sort of less public discrimination.
Now it's enforced by laws. And
now it becomes enforced by laws. Now, I don't think what is altering or changing here is the nature of the racism. What is changing is the appearance of that racism.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it is telling, in the way I read it, again, of their incapacity to actually reason with the facts and with the fundamental fact that they are exclusionary as a political system by nature.
Okay.
And as pressure against them from abroad and from within the country rise, and as they are incapable of responding to popular resistance, which is nonviolent, the last thing they have to do, and I think we've seen precisely the same with South Africa under apartheid in the late years of the 80s and early 90s, is to criminalize dissent and is to up the levels of repression against political activists.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, I think it's also important to bear in mind that there's something good about this, right? I mean, I'm being slightly cynical here, but the good here is that, you know once your enemy, or the people who name themselves your enemy, cannot actually answer you, right? They cannot stand there, call us for a debate on television and say, guys, you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a claim here, right? I think things have become so obvious to everyone across the world by now that as they cannot respond to us, the levels of their fear is rising. And this is also very dangerous. We've seen countries and regimes that are being pushed to the corner against the wall, so to speak, and they respond very violently. And I think my expectation is that if the world doesn't stop it, is going to continue, and we're going to see much more repressive police and army actions.
Yes.
And I think we're going to see activists, also Israelis, being thrown into jail very soon.
Yes.
This is my expectation if we don't stop it.
Yes. Matan, unfortunately, my co-host is making a lot of noise. I ran out of time. This is a topic that actually is very important because it's at the root of everything that is happening. And Israel has been established on pretty much discriminatory laws, and it continues to do it now even more fanatically and more in a very, very interesting fashion. And maybe we will talk about that some other day. So I want to thank you for joining us today, and thank you for all the tremendous work you do for justice. I still maintain that you've risked your life and gave so much for the cause, and I salute you for that. I give my regards to your family, and we'll remain in struggle together. Thank you, Matan.
Thank you. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. And thank you to our listeners, and we'll see you next week and This Week in Palestine.
And that is all we have for today. We wish our listeners a pleasant and restful weekend and look forward to having you with us next week, same time. Until then, this is Sherif Fahm signing off for now and reminding our listeners to get involved. Get involved.